I feel fortunate indeed to be here this morning. Yesterday morning, I went down into our basement to fix a recalcitrant water heater. And as I tried to relight the flame, there was suddenly a swoosh of flame, a cloud of flame in my face. And I learned what it meant to be grateful to God for deliverance. Later in the day, after the fire department had been there and I'd visited an emergency ward in the hospital, I was lying in bed, my face anointed with oil. And a good friend called and said to me, "You know, you're something of a schlamazel." And as a tribute to my mechanical skills, I accepted the compliment. But as a statement of my feelings, I had to push it aside. Schlamazel is an interesting word. It means shelo mazal, one who has no luck. And I felt I'd had good luck. And as I lay in bed yesterday, thinking about the sudden vagaries of life, I thought a good bit about mazel, about luck, about gratitude to God for deliverance. And the word began to play in my mind. And I thought how often we misuse it, and how little we think about it, and in a sense, what the word can teach us about the patterns of thought of our people and of life generally. I suspect if I were to make a list of the 8 or 10 Hebrew words which every Jew knows, one of them certainly would be mazal tov, mazal tov, good luck. It's what we greet a new bride and groom with, or a young bar mitzvah. May your years be as happy, as full of joy as this moment, good luck. But if we press the term, if we look at mazal tov in terms of its etymology and translate it precisely, we find that it takes us back into the folk life, the inner life of our people, to a time when there were all kinds of ideas which were dominant in our culture, which we have moved beyond, and many of which we now find unacceptable. Mazal, a planet, tov, good. Originally, the term mazal tov meant simply, may this occasion be celebrated under a good planet. May your horoscope today be a good one. Mazal tov. Now, Jews know that our tradition has long prized learning and revered the learned man. And as moderns, we assume that one of the signs of learning is that the person with a university degree with some learning has put behind him the superstitions of the Middle Ages, the folk tales and the old wives' tales of a long time ago. And so we assume somehow, falsely it turns out, that our Jewish community was relatively free of the kind of nonsense that's involved in astrology and the casting of horoscopes and all of that. And nothing could be further from the case. Most of the great rabbis of the Talmud, whom I quote to you time and again from this pulpit, were astrologers. The Hebrew word is istagnim, or astrologos, a word that they borrowed from the Greeks. They were adepts at astrology. They wrote books about astrology. Your great-great-grandfather would probably never have signed a contract on Monday because the Talmud told him, and his rabbis repeated to him, that Monday was an inauspicious day to begin any business venture. And as a parent, you would not have married your child off on a Wednesday, because that was the day in which some planets were in the wrong conjunction in heaven for the beginning of a marriage. The rabbis turned to astrology. And astrology and all of that pseudoscience remained a dominant theme among the rabbis of the Talmud and the philosophers of the Middle Ages, with very few exceptions, right down to the beginnings of modern times. Now, as I thought of Mazal Tov and of this history, a cultural history, I reminded myself that there have been a series of long cycles in the interest of our people in astrology. At times, the interests are very high, and at times, not so high, not so dominant. If you turn to the Bible, to the first 1,000 years of Jewish life, you discover that there's not a single incident reported in the Bible which is astrological in its import. It's fascinating, but the only laws that at all seem to touch upon this world are the laws which tell the Israelites that they're not to consult a diviner, or one who casts lots, or one who is a sorcerer. And the Bible uses the term kashtaim, the Chaldeans, as a term synonymous with astrologers, wizards, and these are people you're supposed to push away from. You're not to consult them, and you're not to believe that they have any power over you, that what they say can in any way affect the course of your life. One of the earliest midrashim about Abraham, one of the earliest folk stories about Abraham, tells how Abraham bested in a test of power all of the astrologers of the Chaldean court and freed all of his descendants from any authority that these sorcerers might have over them. So during the first 1,000 years of Jewish history, astrology is put away from us. And during the next 2,000 years of our history, it's brought into the tradition. Why the change? I suspect it goes back to the fact that the Israelites lived on their own land, were sovereign, and felt themselves to a certain degree to be in control of their fate. And the rabbis and the Jews of Talmudic and rabbinic times were dispersed, believed themselves to be in galut, in exile, off of their land, and to have lost control of their fate. The sense of control or the loss of control has a great deal to do with our sense of being dependent upon powers outside ourselves, as if these powers have or do not have authority over our lives. And I would suggest to you that we can trace the thought patterns of the 20th century in similar terms. A generation or two ago, no one who sat where you are sitting, or almost no one, believed in astrology. Astrology was superstition. The horoscope, if it appeared in the paper at all, was something for the lesser breeds, not for us college-educated people. But today, we are in the age of Aquarius. And I've seen young people introduce themselves to each other by their zodiacal sign, by their planet, by their mazal, rather than by their last name. I'm a Gemini, I'm a Capricorn, this kind of thing. Why? What's happened? A generation or so ago, all of us felt that we were in control of our lives, that our machines and our medicine and our way of life and our political system was ultimately going to spread its beneficence throughout the world. Progress was in the air. Optimism was the very nature of our lives, of our feelings, of our emotions. We felt very much in control. And we didn't think that such a thing as luck, good or bad luck, could in any major way affect our lives. But then came the Vietnam, and then came all those staggering moments of uncertainty which unsettled our belief in the machine and medicine and reason, the population bomb, and Stalin and Hitler, all of the evils and the tragedies of the 20th century. And man lost that sense of being in control. And he came more and more to believe that luck governed his life, that his life was governed by some erratic principle of good luck or bad luck. And perhaps at best, he might find out by scanning the heavens what a particular day might be, an increase in some small measure the possibility of good fortune by beginning his contract or naming his child or marrying his child on a propitious moment. Mazal tov. May the planet which governs this day be a lucky one for us. Our very interest in this nonsense called astrology testifies to the shattering of the optimistic spirit of the last 100 years. Our need to feel that somehow we can do a little bit of something to better our lives, though we cannot completely shape them to meet our needs. I announced my topic today as Is Democracy Doomed? I borrowed this title unashamedly from the title of an article which appears in the most recent issue of Commentary Magazine, by a professor of government from the London School of Economics, Eli Kaduri. I was fascinated, frankly, more by the title than by the article itself. And what drew me to the title were the same kinds of ruminations which I found myself engaged in yesterday as I lay in my bed thinking about mazal, mazal tov and mazal ra, about good fortune and bad fortune, about astrology and the history of our people. Is democracy doomed? Could any title more vividly express the loss of faith, faith and confidence in the future, which is part, unfortunately, of the spirit of modern man? A generation ago, we were confident of our future. We were certain that the world would ultimately become democratic, that the Western way of life would ultimately become the habit of life, the second nature to the peoples of the world. I remember reading shortly after the Second World War a long article by Henry Luce, the editor of Time Life, the man who probably more than any other man helped to shape the conventional wisdom in America, in which he pontificated a bit about his understanding of American values. And the whole theme of this effusion was this: America, the West, is a dynamic center from which ideas and habits and practices and laws and ways of life and technology is radiating out to the world. And soon the sunlight of our habit, the sunlight of our customs, the sunlight of our attitudes would shed its light and warm all of the colder, more benighted regions of the world. The dynamic center of an ever-widening sphere of influence and of significance. That's how he described the West, and particularly America. Now, academics and others are writing articles on the theme, is democracy doomed? Interesting change, a significant one to evaluate and to try to understand. And interestingly, as I had analyzed the title, I had been struck by this question of the meaning of words and what words say about our common attitudes. The word doom, for instance, it's a fascinating word. It's from an Old English verb which means to do, to make a judgment. The noun meant simply a judgment. The doomsday book in Old English history was simply a register of all the laws and all the judgments which had been made at a particular assize or a particular court. But such is the peculiar, almost natural, instinctive pessimism of man, that the assumption somehow was made over the centuries that a collection of judgments, of enactments and laws must somehow be severe, be heavy penalties for those who come before the law. And therefore, doom has and develops that freighted connotation it has with us, of capital punishment, of death, of severity. We seal the doom, we seal the fate of a person who stands before the bar of justice. Man, until the 19th century, was by nature a pessimistic fellow. He despaired of this life. It was brief and bruising and impoverished. In economics, was called the dismal silence, a division of insufficiency among too many. There seemed to be no way out of living here as if you were preparing yourself, undergoing some trial, to see whether or not you could benefit, could qualify for the great blessing which lies in the next world, beyond, in some other place. Almost all of the great religious systems of the world are pessimistic. Classic Christianity called this life a via dolorosa, a way of tears. What was the purpose of this life? Not to build here an earthly Jerusalem, a Zion, a city of God on earth, but to live here in such a way that we proved our faith, our quality, that we validated the sheet which would allow us to enter into the beauties of paradise of the world to come. Eastern faiths, the Western faiths, all of them, for the most part, despaired of life. They were pessimistic about the future. And then in the 19th century, man suddenly found he had new powers. He thought that he could use these powers for the common good. The machine would destroy the age-old need for man to be a pack animal, a brute beast of burden. Medicine would enlarge the ambit of life. Instead of having a lifespan of 29 years, it would be a lifespan of 70 years, a natural lifespan for man. We could increase the productivity of the earth and use more intelligently its natural resource. There would be enough for all. A great dream of hope, a happy dream developed among Western men particularly, was an age of confident faith, one of the few such ages in the history of mankind. That age lasted about 100 years. It ended in this century with the cruelties and the tragedies of political life in this century, and with the recognition that for every one of our machines, we pay a price. For the longevity, we pay a price. In life, there's always a price to be paid for any advance, and that we do not have any longer clear, easy, simple solutions for the manifold problems which face us. And so we come to a time when men can write about the doom of the Western way of life, of all that we hold precious. For in Kaduri's articles, as in most of our thought, democracy is a synonym not simply for representative government, but for inalienable rights of man, for due process, for all those freedoms and all that sense and that sense of social justice which we are devoted to and prize. Is our way of life doomed? Now, those who write on this theme, those who think about it, tend to develop their arguments around three large matrices, three large areas. The first has to do with the emergence of the second and third world, the sense that our power is no longer the dominant power in the world. After the Second World War, the Soviet Union, the Second World, took into itself, ingested half of Europe. And the sense of the growing power of the Marxist world, of the communist world, is one which frightens, I think, many of us in the West. So the first sense of loss of control over our lives, the sense that our way of life may be doomed, is a response to the imperialism of the Second World and to the growth in population and numbers and powers of the Third World. A world full of angry voices, an emerging world, a world which will demand its share of resource, food resource, natural resource, energy resource, a world whose population is multiplying, doubling every 20 years, a world which seems to have the most basic of appetites which can be satisfied only by giving to them the abundance of the West, of democracy. And as the Third World emerges, the West is not only faced with a need to share of its abundance, but is faced with the recognition that its way of life is not the emerging way of life among the new nations. They have moved towards dictatorship, towards tyranny, towards oligarchy, towards military junta. We had hoped, most of us in the West, that these newly freed nations, once they had the colonial power had removed its authority, would accept some form of representative government. And in most cases, the West had tried, the imperial power had tried to impose colonial governments, on colonial governments, some form of rudimentary political democracy. But India is, in a sense, the classic example. England had tried to establish there some democratic frame of reference. It lasted for 15 years. And then under Indira Gandhi, we've seen one by one all of these makeshifts, because they did not grow organically from Indian needs, fall apart. And an authoritarian government rule from the top, oligarchy or tyranny, call it what you will, develop in that subcontinent. Wherever we look, in the Second World and the Third World, there are all measure all kinds of threats to our way of life. And there's certainly no encouragement to the belief that out there are others who share our faith in the attitudes, the political, social, and economic attitudes which comprise what we call democracy. The second major area of concern grows out of the fate of Western Europe. Democracy is a term we use easily and perhaps too freely as an equivalent term to the free world, to Western world, Europe and the United States. And when we speak of Western Europe, we speak now of a community which is not simply a community of so-called free societies, but a community where in Italy and in France, The Communist Party may soon become the majority party and take over the apparatus of government. And I think most frightening of all to the West has been the fate of England. We are, after all, the child of England politically and juridically. And we have watched not only the dismemberment of the English Empire during the first 70 years of this century, we've watched in these last years the inability of the English to come alive to the new, diminished, but nevertheless full of possibilities, dimensions of their existence. They suffer, they endure, there is inflation, there is economic stagnation, there's no increase in productivity. We see that neat, tight little island seemingly dividing itself, people trying to leave, a loss of any sense of common purpose. And we wonder if England's fate a few years from now may be our own. And the third area of concern, a third well from which pessimism emerges among us, is from our own lives and what is happening here within the United States, where the era, where the generation has lived through Watergate and through Vietnam. We have seen a loss of faith in the American way of life develop among many of our young, who demanded not only democratic reforms and social reforms, but a total revolution, a total transformation of our way of life. We came awake in the last 20 years or so to many of the not-so-lovely aspects of the American society, that there was an American imperialism, economic if not military, that we did engage in many activities which we thought which we would not be willing to admit openly to the world, covert and overt forms of subversion in countries around the world. And we were shocked and saddened. And we found ourselves, as most of the countries of the world, burdened by inflation, burdened by unemployment, unable to solve the problems of urban society, finding the amenities of our cities diminished rather than increased, finding crime in our streets rather than security. And our spirits have been burdened. And that burden is the third of the burdens which we bear, the third of what one man has called the distempers of democracy, the third of those feelings which have led to this lethargy, this assumption that somehow our way of life is doomed, is diminished, and may not survive. Now, is this so? Is democracy doomed? Nothing is doomed. In life, there's always possibility. That statement is at the very heart of our Jewish faith. In life, there is always possibility. How is it then that the rabbis of the Talmud turned to astrology, could believe that their fate was somehow governed by the stars? What they believed was not that their entire lives were governed by the stars, but that part of their lives was. Mar Samuel, one of the founders of Babylonian Jewry, put it this way: longevity, children, and livelihood depend not on merit, but on the stars. How long we live, whether or not we have children, what kind of children we have, and whether we are wealthy or not, these are a matter of luck, not of merit. And the rabbis were reacting against the long biblical covenantal tradition, which assumed that as you sow, so shall you reap, that there is an inevitable reward for virtue. The psalmist put it this way: I have been a young man, and now I am an old man, and I've never seen a righteous man forsaken by God. There was an inevitable reward for goodness, and obviously there is no inevitable reward for goodness. Life is not a first-grade classroom where every time you hand in a neat paper, a gold star is put next to your name. The rabbis were reacting against a theology which made too many assumptions about God's providential care of the world, about reward and punishment. There are certain things in life which have always been and will always be beyond our control. I was lucky yesterday. I was only superficially scorched. I could have been blinded. It has nothing to do with my merit. It was a matter of luck, of chance, perhaps. The accident need not have happened in the first place. There are certain things which are beyond our control, a matter of luck. You don't have to associate these with the planets, but luck is part of life. We are born at a certain time. Certain things occur during our lifetime which profoundly affect our lives. We are at a certain place at a certain moment when someone stands there who can open a door or will shut a door to us. A great deal that happens to us is a matter of luck, but there are many things which happen to us which are not a matter of luck. On that, the rabbis also insisted. Ein mazal b'Yisrael. In questions of virtue, of obedience to God, in these questions which have to do with the quality of your life, there is no question of luck. It's a matter of will. It's a matter of judgment. It's a matter of wisdom. You can do. There are no guarantees that you will be successful in what you set out to do, but you can do. You can try. You can undertake. You can live by certain values. Nothing forces you to do otherwise. The planets do not have control over Israel, the rabbi says, when Israel is acting in obedience to the will of God. Ein mazal b'Yisrael. Yes, there is luck, and there is chance, but there is no doom, no certain fate. Democracy today is faced with critical challenges from within and from without. But democracy is not doomed, nor is democracy guaranteed. It's up to us. Etymology again, democracy. Demos, kratos, two Greek words. Demos, the people, kratos, power. The people have power. We have the power to forge a strong domestic society, justice. We have the power to equalize opportunity. We have the power to bring about racial integration. If we will it, it need not be a dream. If we will it, it is not impossible. If we will it, we can try to make it happen. The people have power. If we do not use our power to preserve democracy and to increase its ambit and its blessings, democracy will not survive. 200 years ago this month, Edward Gibbon published the first of his many volumes of the classic and magisterial, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. And one of the themes that emerges from these many volumes is the theme that when there is achievement, there is wealth. And when there's wealth, there's luxury. And when there's luxury, there's lethargy and indolence and weakness. In a sense, the achievements, the power of Rome brought about its ultimate downfall because the moral fiber, the will, was somehow corroded. The next generation and the next was somehow weaker than the generation that had been before. And they're not genetically weaker, obviously, but their lives are easier. They are more self-indulgent. They turn in on themselves. Rome moved from questions of law and civic concern to questions of luxury and aesthetic concern, to indulgence. Is democracy doomed? Not if those who are the demos, the people, are willing to exert themselves, to discover again their civic responsibilities. Democracy is doomed only if we continue to live as a community concerned only with our narrow, selfish interests, seeking personal fulfillment at the expense of the common weal, turned on to ourselves but turned off to politics, turned off to the social issues of the day, eager to play the games, but not to play the game of life. I've been struck by the fact that our nation is one of the few nations of the world which does not demand so many years of service from each and every one of its citizens. In many societies, Israel being a classic example, the young must serve in one capacity or another for a given number of years, and there is continuing service throughout one's productive years. In America, we live in and for ourselves, and the Peace Corps, and VISTA, and institutions such as this are anemic shadows of their possibility. We'd really in America, if we're honest, have not taken seriously the responsibilities of the citizen as citizen. That is not to say that many of us do not try, but that many more of us are indifferent. I'm not very much impressed when I read all the pundits who speak about the anger of the politician against the politicians on the part of those who vote, or the electorate. I'm more concerned about the indifference of the electorate to the whole social and civic process. How many people are involved in community issues? The same people over and over again. The same minority over and over again. How many people think of devoting some measure of their lives to the schools in their community, or to the recreational needs of their community, or to the political growth of their community? Very few. Most lead their own lives and ask only to be let alone. Is democracy doomed? Yes, if we let it alone. If we assume that it will survive on its own, that others will do it for us. Is democracy doomed? Not at all. We can create or work towards the creation, for there are no guarantees, of a fine human society. There are great resources, human, physical, all about us. America has great achievements, far more than America now admits to ourselves, because we're in one of those moods of self-criticism. We've created a good society. And 90% of the American people are in this America, not the other America, within the ambit of opportunity, not without the ambit. We have done great things in America and can do more, if there is the will. To a Jew, there is no such thing as a fate which governs our lives. There is luck, to be sure. But ultimately, we and we alone determine the quality of our lives, the values by which we will live. It's a matter of will, of commitment, of determination. Democracy. Demos kratos, the power of the people. May this people be a powerful and committed one. Amen.